the major political task that together we face in the next 5 months is to make certain that Donald Trump is defeated and defeated badly. And I personally intend to begin my role in that process in a very short period of time.
That was the promise made by Bernie Sanders just a couple of weeks ago. And this past week, it has become a lot more clear what that particular role is. So he's already met with Hillary Clinton. We'll get to that in just a minute. He has fired his press secretary. So that's another move. He's began giving speeches where he's not talking about being president anymore and talking more about continuing his political revolution, which I believe the point was the entire time. But he still has not completely warmed up to Miss Hillary yet. It's coming, though. I'm certain of it. But even after the recent sit-down, the words he had to say about her weren't as glowing as perhaps they could have been.
I recently had the opportunity to meet with Secretary Clinton and discuss some of the very important issues facing our country and the Democratic Party. It is no secret that Secretary Clinton and I have strong disagreements on some very, very important issues. It is also true that our views are quite close on others. I look forward in the coming weeks to continued discussion between the two campaigns.
There are signs of the two campaigns coming together, but then there are still some very stark differences. Now, we discussed on a recent show how Bernie Sanders got people on the committee to draft the platform. Hillary Clinton got some people, Bernie Sanders got some people, and then, of course, Debbie Wasserman Schultz, as the head of the DNC, she got some people. And recently, one of the people, and the platform is already coming together right now, one of the folks that was sat down at that platform by Hillary came out against the $15 an hour minimum wage. So, two problems. First of all, you're on the committee. You're writing the platform. You're for the Democratic nominee. You've already come out against the $15 an hour minimum wage. Now, it's no secret that initially Hillary started at 12 or 13. She was never 15 until it was pretty clear how popular it was with Bernie Sanders supporters, and she needs those people to win. So Hillary is now appearing on the road with Elizabeth Warren. Elizabeth Warren is very much behind the $15 an hour minimum wage, and on the trail, Hillary herself is for the $15 an hour minimum wage. So what the hell is going on the platform?
Admit it, though. Hillary trying to appeal to young voters is a little bit like your relative who just signed up for Facebook. Yeah. Dear America, did you get my poke? Is it appearing on your wall? I'm not sure I'm using this right. Love, Aunt Hillary.
It's pretty easy to make fun of Hillary at this point, because what we're seeing is we're seeing her campaign come together before our eyes. Where she started, then through the primary, and where she's at now. So a lot of Bernie supporters are feeling absolutely defeated. I see it on social media. They're still sharing back and forth about how they got screwed by the Democratic Party. And yes, I will tell you that the cards were against Bernie Sanders. There's no two ways about that. But let's be frank. Bernie agreed to the process. Bernie knew what the rules were. And Bernie has pointed out about the Hillary Victory Fund and about the superdelegates all getting together and pledging for somebody before he got in. And even with that, he still got 47% of the vote. He still won more than 20 states. And the platform does have his people on it right now. And we have a candidate with Hillary Clinton who is now moving to the left. And I'm with you. She shouldn't have to move to the left. She should already be to the left. But hey, at least we're getting some of the things we want. If Hillary Clinton becomes president, you know, she's not my particular candidate, but the fact that she's appearing on the road with Elizabeth Warren says to me that that might be her VP. And if that's not her VP, boy, you guys are spending an awful lot of time together for two people who aren't going to spend the next 4 to 8 years together.
Violence is absolutely and totally unacceptable. And I do not want anybody, if people are thinking about violence, please do not tell anybody you are a Bernie Sanders supporter, because those are not the supporters that I want. I understand how reprehensible and disgraceful Donald Trump's positions are, how ignorant they are, how much he is appealing. And I can understand the anger. I surely can, because I feel it. The bigotry that is coming from his mouth, the insults to the Mexican community and the Latino community and the Muslim community and women and African Americans and veterans. I understand the anger, but we are not going to defeat Trump, you know, by throwing eggs or getting involved in violence of any kind.
It was a pretty bruising primary. And so the idea or the concern was that there was going to be a gigantic split, a gigantic Democratic split. So for some context, at about this time, 8 years ago, the folks, the Hillary supporters that said that they would never support Barack Obama, never, you know, or they'd vote for John McCain, was somewhere in the 30s. And by the time it got to October, this was a, I believe this was an ABC poll. By the time it got to October, that number, now October, just before November, you know the way a calendar works, that number was still 14%. So the number of folks that said that they would never, the Bernie supporters that said they would never vote for Hillary, was somewhere in the neighborhood of 20% fairly recently. According to the most recent poll to come out, it is now at 8%. And we, as of the taping of this episode, are in June. By the time you hear it, it will be July. But already that number's ticking down faster than it did in 2008. So the split doesn't seem to be quite the split that we thought that it was.
What about Bernie Sanders and his supporters? Are you at all concerned?
No, I'm not. Bernie Sanders is a good guy. Bernie Sanders is... I think we should do... Look, I think... Let Bernie run the race. I mean, there's nothing wrong.
Did he adequately
condemn
his supporters?
Did you watch the videos in Las Vegas?
No, but that's not Bernie. And Bernie, you know, I think what Bernie's going to have to do, if that happens again, is going to have to be more aggressive in speaking out about it. So I'm confident that Bernie will be supportive if Hillary wins, which the numbers indicate will happen. And so I'm not worried. There's no fundamental split or anything in the Democratic Party.
By the time Biden said that, Bernie had already came out. That clip that I played beforehand, suppose I should have played those in order. That clip that I played beforehand was Bernie denouncing the violence, saying, hey, these are not my supporters. And then Biden saying, chill, don't worry. Bernie's a good guy. We got this. There's no fundamental split. But there are still quite a few Bernie people who feel slighted, who feel dismissed. And to a large degree, those feelings are quite legitimate, and they still need to be answered. Bernie built up a grassroots. I'm getting pressure here and there from some folks who are a little bit more to the left, perhaps, than I am, I suppose. I don't know how else to put it. And there's go for Jill Stein. Vote for Jill Stein. I like Jill Stein. I don't have a problem with Jill Stein. That's not, and I'm not going to say I wouldn't vote for her. I certainly would, but it's not likely she's going to get my vote during this cycle. Here's the thing. Bernie built up an entire grassroots army. I remember seeing a video of a little more than a year ago, Bernie Sanders giving speeches in living rooms, giving speeches in backyards, and those venues became those venues, and then those venues became stadiums, and then those stadiums electrified the entire nation. Bernie started small, went here, went there, went everywhere. When I saw him, when he came to Washington State, when he came to Vancouver, Washington, he did three cities in one day. He did Vancouver for breakfast, he did Seattle for lunch, and then Spokane for dinner. Three places in one day. He gave these speeches, he had this tremendous fundraising, and he was an absolute road dog. That's a music term. And he built up this huge coalition. That's a man who is not only ready to be president, but understand what it takes to become president. See, when Bernie decided to run, he was going to run as an independent. Why? Because he's always run as an independent, and he's won quite a few elections doing so. But he realized to win a national election, an election that is not Vermont, he had to do something drastic. He had to do something different. So he decided to run as a Democrat, decided to run inside the Democratic Party. Yeah, he's still the same guy that he has been for 30 years. But he knew what he had to do if he really wanted to win a national election. Jill Stein, short of that kind of a support group, isn't going to win. No matter how much I like her, no matter how much my friends like her, that's a bubble. I essentially live in a bubble of Stein supporters, and that's fine. I don't have a problem with her, but you can't win a national election without the kind of broad support that Bernie built up. With that said, Bernie's realized what he built up and has decided, to some degree, he's letting us down sort of slowly right now. He gets rid of some staffers. He gets rid of his press secretary. You know, he meets with Hillary Clinton. It's this slow, slow drawdown, but he's not done yet.
Senator Bernie Sanders has been a consistent man of his word. Mm. And when he says he's going all the way to the convention, he is going all the way. The senator gave the same speech, as you know, that he has given countless times about what is important in this country in terms of social justice, criminal justice, economic justice, getting big money out of politics so that the voices of everyday people are not drowned out. But so Senator Sanders is still just as strong and committed to all of those issues as he ever has been. And so in many ways, this is his life's work. You know, this is not something that he just started. I think one of his colleagues in the Senate once said, and I forget what senator said it, but he said, you know, Senator Sanders has been saying this to us for the last 30 years. And you know what? Democrats in the Congress weren't listening, so he took it to the people.
That's Nina Turner. I have very much enjoyed her in this election. She really came out for Bernie in a big way. And because Bernie, for whatever reason, seemed to have trouble with the African-American vote, folks like her, Killer Mike, and then, of course, the gentleman who runs Black Men for Bernie came out and said, hey, these are your issues. Tried to get African-American voters more in the Bernie camp. It didn't work. Well, not to the degree that we needed it to, because a large section of African-Americans decided to go for Hillary Clinton. But we are where we are right now. And all is not lost. Now, to the Bernie supporters who have abandoned this entirely and said, nope, to hell with him, to hell with his campaign, to hell with any of this. I think you need to realize that although we may have lost the race, Bernie won the debate, hands down, because his issues are going to be a part of the November election. His issues are being openly discussed or, if you go to right-wing radio, openly derided. And his issues resonate with everybody. All of the issues that he has, 60% or better support for everything that he believes in. This is a man that, yes, could have won the presidential election. And his issues are still out there and they're still being discussed. And not just that. We have to get to the Bernie-crats. The Democratic Party is ripe for a takeover. There's an article over at The Nation titled The Future of Bernie Sanders' Grassroots Army. And they point out the Bernie-crat organizations that are popping up all over the place. To name just a few, Brand New Congress. And I've talked about this before. An effort launched about a month or so ago to elect a new Congress in 2018. Because we begin the work now for the Congress that will win in 2018. Which will enact Bernie's program regardless of who is in the White House. The Working Families Party, which in many states provided the ground troops for the Sanders campaign and is now benefiting from and struggling to digest a huge influx of new recruits. The People's Summit, an alliance of National Nurses United and People for Bernie, the latter a coalition of activists and online groups like Vets for Bernie and Jews for Bernie that has called for a gathering of the tribes in Chicago and represents more of the elements of the Sanders campaign. The movement. It's all about the movement and not the moment. I don't understand the all or nothing. Bernie's the president or nothing. Even if Bernie had become the president, if he wasn't as effective down ticket, then we would have just had another presidency where not a lot of good would have happened. And we might be in the same place 8 years from now. with another hardcore racist running for president, or even in 4 years. We have to realize that little more than a year ago, these issues were not being discussed. There were a lot of young people that were not involved in the political process. There were a lot of people who weren't awake or alive. Not to these issues, certainly. And now they are. And now they're getting involved. Brand new Congress is using the Bernie model. One group to raise all the money. You run for Congress and 6,000 people, after hearing Bernie speak online the other night, 6,000 people have pledged to run. I don't understand the all or nothing. What we accomplished is huge. Yeah, we didn't get our nominee, but what we accomplished is huge. And the movement is very much alive.
The insiders wrote the rules of the game to keep themselves in power and in the money. That's why we're asking Bernie Sanders voters to join our movement. So together we can fix the system for all Americans so important.
But that's not going to stop Captain White Power from going after your vote. Trump would still very much like the Bernie supporters to be on his side. Hey, we're not done yet. And we're not going to follow Mr. White Power. Well, most of us aren't going to follow Mr. White Power. I can't explain the 8% that say that they're still going to vote for him. But I'm not in that camp. I was never in that camp. Mr. Trump, you do not have my vote, no matter what kind of language you use.
Love Trump because we know he'll go to Washington and break it.
That's the problem. Everyone that you have been sending to Washington, D.C., or just about everybody that we've been sending to Washington, D.C., has just been freaking breaking it. And we don't need more breaking it. That's Wayne Allen Root, libertarian. He's run for president before in the past. You want to look him up? Root for America. .com or dot, I don't know which one it is, Root for America, which is weird, because arguing that we should send Trump to the White House to break America is not the same as rooting for America. But then again, libertarians have never made any sense to me. There's an article that came out a little while ago in Gawker, and it's stunning to me how much racism is being used openly in the campaign right now, and it's not costing Trump any votes. If anything, it's only made him more popular. Quite a few white power groups now have come out. White nationalists, the Klan, they've said that they're going to show up to the Republican National Committee, and they're going to protect Trump. They're going to protect Trump supporters. Now, here's the thing, and I've mentioned this before. I don't know that he's going to make it all the way to the national convention. But if he does, and he doesn't get the nomination, there's going to be white power hell to pay. So there was an article a little while back in Gawker. This goes to the point that Trump is not a new racist. Racist going way back. And I've got some thoughts on this. So Donald Trump, quoting from Gawker here, once argued having 9 blacks square off against 9 whites would produce the highest ratings in television. Trump made the proposal in 2005 on the Howard Stern show, where he took a break from discussing how often his wife defecates, which apparently is never, to propose his own version of Helter Skelter. BuzzFeed, which dug up the news, also published transcript of the audio. Quote, on The Apprentice, there was a concept. Okay. Thrown out by some person, 9 blacks against 9 whites, said Trump. And it would be 9 blacks against 9 whites, all highly educated, very smart, strong, beautiful. Do you like it? Do you like it, Robin? Robin, sitting in the studio there, of course is black. Robin, Stern's co-host, suggested that it might cause a riot. And Trump proclaimed, no, no, no. It would be the highest rated show in television. Beautiful. I'm telling you. Very dark blacks or light-skinned blacks, Stern asked. Assortment, Trump responded, against whites. When a laughing quiver asked how many blondes, this was striking to me, Trump added he wanted all nine whites to be blonde. Blonde hair, blue eyes, Wouldn't that set off a race war? Asked Stern. Actually, I don't think it would, responded Trump. It would be handled very beautifully by me. He's always talked the same. Because as you know, I'm very diplomatic. Also, I think you'd have 35 million people a night watching. Pitting white people against black people and calling it beautiful. Why not pit rich people against poor people?
Tonight, the Trump campaign is answering new questions. Did they select a delegate who is a well-known white nationalist? ABC Cecilia Vega on the campaign tonight.
Late today, Trump facing his own new controversy. One of the people on his list of California delegates is prominent white nationalist William Johnson, whose group recorded robocalls supporting Trump.
He will put America first. Furthermore, he will respect all women and will help preserve Western civilization.
The campaign tonight blaming it on a computer error, saying they didn't mean to submit Johnson's name as a delegate to the convention.
They knew very well who Johnson was. Johnson had recorded and paid for white nationalist robocalls in several states. And internally, the Trump campaign saw that as good because they believe it may have actually helped them get more votes. There's no denying that a generation of white nationalists have all come together behind Trump. And the stories of race and violence that are coming out are being highlighted more than ever, because it's pretty clear that we are now living in an America with a climate, a racist climate. So President Obama gets so much guff because they say he was supposed to bring all the races together. He didn't bring all the races together, that end bomb. Well, yeah, it doesn't work that way. By simply being black, that doesn't bring folks together. And you don't get to blame him for not being able to bring you ignorant rednecks over to the side because you're not less racist now that we have a black president. That's not fair. And it's not his fault. And he did try. And he did speak on race relations. But you just can't convince some people. And so Trump, speaking very openly in racist terms, has white nationalists working for him, was very tepid about saying that he doesn't want the David Duke endorsement. It doesn't matter. You freaking have it now. So there was a story that came out recently about how the taunting at a basketball game against some Latino players coming from the white players went like this. Trump's gonna deport you. Trump's gonna deport you. And then in Forest Grove, Oregon, fairly close to Portland, somebody decided to hang a sign saying, build the wall. Just anonymously hung a sign saying, build the wall. And there's a large Latino population at that school. They came out very starkly against that. They marched in protest. Eventually, the boy came out and said, I'm sorry, I didn't realize this was such a bad thing. And maybe he didn't realize it was such a bad thing, because racism has become more normal in 2016. So this from Brad Reed over at Raw Story. Three white high school football players from Dietrich, Idaho, and I've lived out there before, not in Dietrich, but I lived in Spokane, and I've spent quite a bit of time in North Idaho, and they are racist. It's the Deep South, even though they're up north. Three high school football players from Dietrich, Idaho, have been charged in a brutal sexual assault on a black teammate. This according to the Washington Post. The assault took place in October 23rd of last year in the men's locker room at their high school, Dietrich High School. Law enforcement officials allege that one of the football players restrained the victim, while another, if there's kids in the room, get them out the room. They don't need to hear this, all right? Just go ahead and pause. All right, you got them out the room? All right, here we go. One of the football players restrained the victim, while another shoved a coat hanger up his rectum, while another football player repeatedly kicked the coat hanger. Two of the alleged perpetrators, 18-year-old John R.K. Howard and 17-year-old Tanner Ward, are being charged as adults. An unnamed 16-year-old player is being charged in the case as a juvenile. Howard has not yet filed a plea in the case, and it isn't known whether Ward has filed a plea. The unidentified victim's family has also filed a $10 million lawsuit alleging that his vicious sexual assault was the culmination of harassment, a harassment campaign against him. The family alleges, Melvin, how do you know this is about his race? Easy now, I'm getting to it. The family alleges that his teammates would regularly insult him with racially charged terms, and the suit alleges he was regularly called Kool-Aid, Chicken Eater, Watermelon, and the N-word. This according to the Washington Post. This from New Haven, Connecticut, according to Raw Story. A New Haven, Connecticut schoolboy and his family are accusing his classmates of targeting him for physical and verbal attacks because he is Jewish. The New Haven Register reports, Orit Avizov, told a local news station that her 12-year-old was physically attacked and verbally threatened by one student who was yelling, "Kill the Jew," during the attack. Brantford Public Schools is committed to ensuring each school maintains a safe environment for all students, Brantford Superintendent of Schools Hamlet Hernandez said in a statement to the New Haven Register. The district strongly condemns inappropriate behavior toward any student, including bullying, violence, or racial attacks. All claims of misconduct are prohibited behavior and are investigated and addressed in a timely, thorough, and judicious manner by the administration. But the student said that the school should have done more. While other parents complained of bullying, Avizov said her son's heritage was what made him a target. The kids started yelling, "Kill the Jew, kill the Jew, kill the Jew," while they were attacking my son, she told local news.
So I looked, you know, Hillary Clinton has somebody. Did you ever hear of Pocahontas? Huh? It's Pocahontas, Elizabeth Warren. She was going out. She is probably the senator that's doing just about the least in the United States Senate. She's a total failure. She said she was an Indian. She said because her cheekbones were high, she was an Indian, that she was Native American. And, you know, we have these surrogates, people like her, total failures. And we're not going to take it anymore, okay? We're not going to take it anymore.
If you want to complain,
Pocahontas.
If you want to complain about the job that somebody does, complain about it on its merits, what they've done, what they haven't done, accomplished, haven't accomplished. Pocahontas is racist. And he was called out in New Mexico by a Native American reporter, by an Indian reporter, who said to his face, "That's racist. Please don't say that." And then he said, right to that reporter's face, "Pocahontas?
Look at my African-American over here. Look at him. Are you the greatest? You know what I'm talking about?"
By the way, he's not your African-American. We do not own them anymore. Or perhaps nobody has told you that. So there's an article by Allegra Kirkland over at Talking Points Memo. The headline, "Great White Hope. Trump unites generations of white nationalists." His retweets of Twitter users with handles like @WhiteGenocide and his tepid disavowals of David Duke's support have not gone unnoticed in the fringe community. Tucked away in the woods in the middle of Tennessee's Montgomery Bell State Park, 300 white advocates gathered at the 14th American Renaissance Conference to reflect on just how much fuel Trump has added to their movement this election cycle. "I've never felt this sense of energy in our movement," the conference host Jared Taylor said in his opening remarks. "I've never been more optimistic." For the conference, American Renaissance, a white nationalist publication, brought advocates for white ethno-state together with Holocaust deniers, eugenicists, and Confederate sympathizers. The American Renaissance and many of the groups the conference speakers are associated with are designated as hate groups by the Southern Poverty Law Center, which, by the way, Sean Hannity says the Southern Poverty Law Center just hates conservatives. So clearly, conservative must mean racist by extension. White nationalist, right? At the conference, anti-immigrant, pro-Confederate old-timers rub shoulders with the young men of the alt-right. Remember that term. A loosely defined amalgam of isolationist and white nationalists who crusade against political correctness and thrive on the internet. Quote, "Trump is probably the first politician I've seen, perhaps in my entire life, that I would go and vote for," said Nathan Domingo, a social science major from Northern California, sporting a fasci haircut. a two-tour Iraq veteran, Domingo praised Trump as the only one in the GOP to condemn the invasion as a mistake. Almost every conference attendee Talking Points Memo spoke with said he or she voted for Trump in the primaries. A few, like William Johnson, have done much, much more than the rest of them, though. Johnson, the founder of the white nationalist American Freedom Party, poured thousands of dollars into his American National Super PAC effort to blanket early voting states with robocalls urging voters to back Trump.
Okay, so you've been in the news a lot.
Lately I have, yes.
And your political views are you are a white nationalist.
Yes, I'm a nationalist, and nationalism is coming popular right now. And Donald Trump is making it popular. We're battling the globalism that's been in place for the last 40, 50 years, and Donald Trump is leading the charge.
Donald Trump is making white nationalism popular.
He's making nationalism popular. I'm a white nationalist, but you would call him an American nationalist. And just like nationalism is becoming popular in the Philippines, in Egypt, and in Europe, he's making it popular here in the United States.
This one sent chills up my spine. There was a young Trump supporter, white nationalist, that walked up to the Talking Points Memo reporter and said, just walked right up to her and said, "There's more of us than you think. We are crashing the plane. No survivors." And then walked away. That sent chills up this old boy's spine. But you know what? In the editorial comments here, I now realize that they were... That is a line from the Batman villain Bane from The Dark Knight Rises. Still, the white nationalist movement sees coverage of Trump's anti-immigration policies as key to spreading their ideals. Which, by the way, that's what you're doing, American media. You're helping him spread these white nationalist ideas. And why is our media helping promote white nationalist ideas, whether they like it or not? Because what they do on radio and television, they have to do for profit. And if that means promoting a white nationalist, then by God, they're going to support a white nationalist. Despite their warm embrace of Trump, speakers and attendees at the conference said they didn't believe that he is one of them, or that he will be able to fulfill all of the promises on immigration. Instead, they frame their relationship to Trump's campaign as a marriage of convenience. They get to see some of their core beliefs mainstreamed by the presumptive nominee of one of the country's two major political parties while he gets to appeal to disgruntled white voters. Johnson, the white nationalist, believes that Trump should simply override the judicial and legislative branches to make whatever immigration reforms he chooses. Quote, "You could have a Trump do what Andrew Jackson did when he defied the U.S. Supreme Court and had the Trail of Tears," Johnson said, pointing out that the president controls the armies. "It might be violating the procedures we've used for some 100-plus years, but it's not unconstitutional," he continued. "I think we need to have some strong executive decisions because America has disintegrated so much that something dramatic needs to be done."
What would you do as commander-in-chief if the U.S. military refused to carry out those orders?
They won't refuse. They're not going to refuse me, believe me.
But they're illegal.
For those of you not familiar with the Trail of Tears, and I myself... am of Native American ancestry, Blackfoot. For those of you that don't know, and I was going to just describe it on my own, but I went ahead over to PBS, and I pulled a short but apt description, the Trail of Tears. In 1838 and 1839, as part of Andrew Jackson's Indian removal policy, the Cherokee Nation was forced to give up its lands east of the Mississippi River and migrate to an area that is now present-day Oklahoma. The Cherokee people called this journey the Trail of Tears because of its devastating effects. The migrants faced hunger, disease, and exhaustion on the forced march. Over 4,000 out of 15,000 of the Cherokees died. And these white nationalists are saying, you know what? That's what Trump needs to do. Trump needs to have a modern-day Trail of Tears. And you think he's not racist? And I listen to a lot of conservative talk radio, and I hear all the time, he's not racist. What?
If he's a social pariah, why are they so engaging? Why are they so open about it? And I think it's the common people. It's not the 0.1% elite. It's the everyday common employee who wants to get back to work, and this country has to get back to work. And Trump is, you know, I'll tell you, I think he's a racist for the American employee, and I think it's what people are resonating for. He wants to get America back to work, and I think that's a great thing. I hope you don't edit that out.
It's live.
It's so live.
Okay, so that's Peridata CEO Scott Slicker, who says he's a racist for the American worker. Perhaps, Scott, you don't understand the way racism works, but this kind of talk is everywhere right now.
The thing about the Mexicans and you know, murderers and rapists.
They have come here to murder and rape our people. We know that. It's not like, doesn't mean everybody has. Doesn't mean everyone who comes across the border is a nasty, horrible person, but they have violated our laws.
And now we're returning to the bad old days of being racist. Openly racist. Openly profiling people. I saw a Newsweek article a little while back after Freddie Gray was killed. And by the way, thrown into the back of the van, complaining that something was wrong, going on a rough ride. Of course, the officers that killed him have now been exonerated. He was fine when he woke up that morning. He was dead by the end of the day. I don't know why that's okay. And you can say that it has nothing to do with race. You can go ahead and use the word thug. But you know as well as I do, that's racist. And you're profiling.
You know what? We got to stop profiling. We got to stop profiling when people act like a terrorist, when people start growing that facial hair and start growing that facial hair around their chin. And because we know for one thing with
that's criminal profiling.
Hold on
that's
a second.
Racial profiling. Well, so no. that's nothing wrong with that.
Oh, there's nothing wrong with
you. Nothing wrong with what you just said.
With profiling?
With that type
okay.
of profiling. There's criminal profiling and there's racial profiling.
And when
profiling.
People are acting,
profiling.
When people are acting in their garage at 3 o'clock in the morning, you see Middle East looking guys walking in and out at 3 o'clock in the morning.
Now you can't hold on. Now you can't just say Middle Eastern guys. Now that's inappropriate.
Well, why?
That is racially profiling.
But why is it
Middle Eastern?
When I saw the cover of Newsweek, it showed the riots that happened after Freddie Gray's death, and it said 1968, that was crossed out, and 2016 was put over it. As if to say, all of this, and nothing has changed. So has nothing changed, or have we gone backwards? Because this very conservative candidate has decided that being racist is the best way to win the presidency. So far, it's gotten him the nomination, and it very well may get him the presidency. So he runs as an open racist. And then, recently, he's trying to pivot. He's doing things like using a teleprompter and trying not to use as bombastic language. And recently came out and said, you know what, maybe we're not going to have a mass exodus of Muslims entering the U.S. Quoting from Slate here, even without the details, it appeared to mark quite a shift from his previous written down position of a total and complete shutdown of Muslims entering the U.S. That statement is still on his website, but the Trump press secretary, Hope Hicks, confirmed that this is indeed the policy, although she said that it wasn't really anything new. The Washington Post explains, Hicks said in an email that her boss took his new position, which is a dramatic scaling back of the position, which he first took in December during a speech nearly 2 weeks ago. In that speech, Trump did not mention Muslims and called for a temporary ban on certain people from certain horrible places where you have tremendous terrorism in the world. You know what those places are. At the time, it appeared that Trump was expanding his ban to include more people, not limiting his scope. Trump, quote, does not support banning all foreign Muslims, just Muslims from terrorist states, that according to his press secretary. Then, in an interview with Bloomberg, he criticized President Obama's policies on the issue, saying that he has mass deported vast numbers of people. Now, wait a minute. This was the platform, the crux of his campaign. Hardcore racism. Come out against the Mexicans. Come out against the Muslims. And now he appears to be walking that back a little bit. Is this a tactic? Do the white nationalists understand this? Can he still win without being a hardcore freaking racist?
Well, first of all, I just think it's very interesting that we're talking about racially profiling in the context of mass shootings. The vast majority of people who are doing the mass shootings in America are not Muslims at all. So exactly, the young white men. It turns out that even the people who are ideologically motivated, you mentioned ideology, you are seven times more likely to be killed by a right-wing extremist, a racist or an anti-government nut job, seven times more likely to be killed by that person
than
by
a Muslim. But is that ideology important to your consideration? Yes, it is.
Well, sure. But I'm just saying
sure.
before we even just go down the road of should we racially profile Muslims or not, if I came on TV and said, let's start racially profiling white men, let's start racially profiling young white men who are loners with bowl haircuts, people would think, wow, that's a pretty unfortunate conclusion for you to come to. Certainly there's a better way for us to move forward. So I just think it's important for us to recognize we have so much associated the religion of Islam with shooting. If a Christian shoots somebody, we don't say a Christian shot him. But if a Muslim shoots somebody, we say a Muslim shot him. I think that's starting to muddy the water.
And let's not forget that Trump has no problem using immigrant labor. He's used it in the past. He's using it right now in his hotels. And this was one of the things that he was criticized for in the Republican debates.
You're the only person on the stage that's ever been fined for hiring people to work on your projects illegally.
Marco is exactly right that a federal court found Donald guilty of being part of a conspiracy to hire people illegally and entered a $1 million judgment against him.
If he builds the wall the way he built Trump Towers, he'll be using illegal immigrant labor to do it.
Anyone who really cared about illegal immigration wouldn't be hiring illegal immigrants.
So now you have a hardcore racist, somebody who has said disparaging things about Mexicans, about Muslims, about women, and he's using immigrant labor. He's got the white nationalists behind him, and he's very tepid in the way he disavows them. And now, one of the party's standard bearers is joining hundreds of other conservative writers, commentators, bloggers. The intellectual minds inside their party are now beginning to flee. This is one of the reasons I say he won't make it to the convention. The donors are starting to flee. This according to Politico. George Will leaves the GOP. Conservative columnist George Will, and if you've never heard of him, this is a big one, has left the Republican Party. The longtime commentator reportedly made the announcement during a Federalist Society event in Washington, D.C. recently. Will, who resides in Maryland, said he changed his affiliation this month from Republican to unaffiliated. A report from PJ Media quoted Will as saying, "This is not my party." He also said that it's too late for the Republican Party to nominate someone who isn't Donald Trump, an idea that those in the Never Trump movement have been holding on to as the convention nears. Quote, "Make sure he loses," he said. "Grit their teeth for 4 years and then win the White House." Brian Bartlett, who worked for Mitt Romney, is a Never Trumper. Glenn Beck, Michael Berry, Brent Bazell, Bruce Carroll. The list goes on. Stephen Gretowski of the Free Beacon, Stephen Hayes of the Weekly Standard, Doug Hay, former RNC Communications Director, Robert Kagan, former Reagan official, Randy Kendrick, GOP mega donor. There's 100 people on this list, and a lot of them are even donors. And by the way, the Republican Party is not the people's party. It's the party of the rich and the powerful. They will elect who the donors say to elect, and the donors are fleeing right now.
Here's something you're going to have to see to believe, and even then, still really hard to understand. An 8-year-old using a loaded gun trying to rob a West Palm Beach grocery store. This child seen walking into the store here with a motorcycle helmet on. Police say he had a gun, tried to hold the store up before being stopped by employees. The boy's mother says she was at home at the time, then she realized something wasn't right.
When I grabbed my purse, it was so light. I'm like, oh, you know, I knew I was missing something. I was like, where my gun? The first thing I thought, like, I hope Jaden don't have my gun.
At the moment, I didn't know if it was a real gun or fake, but I took it seriously. As soon as I moved, I reached over to him, twisted his wrist, took the gun away.
The boy's mother says she wishes she would have kept the gun somewhere safer. Police have not filed charges yet against the boy or his mother.
I've made the argument in the past that one of the more important things about this election or any election is certainly the Supreme Court. We currently have a vacancy on the Supreme Court. And with a lot of these folks either in their 80s or on their very close to their 80s, there's going to be a lot of seats open very soon. There's already one. Donald Trump has already came out with a who's who of who he would put on the Supreme Court. And he can't freaking wait to put people on that Supreme Court. They're going to give him what he wants. Conservatives call them conservative, originalist, strong, beautiful. And recently, we had some Supreme Court decisions come down that favored a person like myself. We had an abortion decision that we'll talk about here in just a little bit. We also had one come out about guns. And the case at hand was there were a couple of men who were suing who had been arrested for domestic abuse in the past. And what they were mad about was that they were not able to get guns anymore because of their past history of domestic abuse. They saw that as an infringement on their rights. And how dare we here in America, when they're being told by conservative talk radio, Fox News, and the NRA that no matter what, they should get to have a gun. But the Supreme Court saw it differently, with an exception. Justice Thomas. Justice Clarence Thomas rarely speaks out from the bench, but he broke his silence today, and at issue was Voisin versus the United States. Quoting from Think Progress, it's a technical question of whether two men with convictions for reckless domestic assault fall under federal law prohibiting people convicted of misdemeanor crime of domestic violence from possessing a firearm. The law prohibiting domestic abusers from possessing firearms wasn't the question under discussion. Instead, the question was how far the law reached over certain states differing domestic assault laws. Judge Thomas, however, was very concerned in his arguments about the broader law that domestic abusers can't have guns, breaking 10 years of silence on the court to complain at arguments in February. Give me another area where a misdemeanor violation suspends a constitutional right, he asked, later suggesting that the particular domestic abusers in this case shouldn't lose their ability to carry guns because they never really used the gun against a family member. Once they kill their family members, like Christy Sheets did, then maybe they should lose that right. But even then, probably not. I'm editorializing, clearly. The law prohibiting gun ownership by those convicted of misdemeanor assault is already very broad, Thomas writes. It imposes a lifetime ban on gun ownership for a single intentional, non-consensual touching of a family member. The majority seeks to expand the already broad rule to any reckless physical injury or non-consensual touch. I would not extend the statute into that constitutionally problematic territory. He then went on to defend the abusers. But know this, many high-profile mass shooters have a history of domestic violence. And just a few recent examples, the man who shot up the Pulse nightclub earlier this month, killing 49 and wounding 53, allegedly violently abused his wife, his first wife, during their brief marriage. The man who attacked the Colorado Springs Planned Parenthood last year, killing 3 and wounding 9, had previously been charged with sexually assaulting women at knife point and had reports and orders of protection filed against him for physically assaulting his wife and stalking his neighbor. A similar trend bears out in the story of the man who opened fire on a packed movie theater on Lafayette, Louisiana in July 2015. In 2008, his wife and daughter had filed orders of protection against him for acts of family violence, as reported by The Trace. But Justice Thomas raged in support of domestic abusers getting to carry guns.
Described as cowardice is, I don't know what else to call it. Cowards are people who talk really tough in the hope that they will not be asked to actually act and do something. And the truth is, that's exactly what Republicans have done. Republicans have run around and spent the last week saying radical Islamic extremism to anybody who will listen. But when it actually comes to preventing those extremists from being able to walk into a gun store and buy a gun, they're AWOL. They won't do anything about it because they're scared of the NRA.
Josh.
That's shameful.
There was also a case that went in front of the Supreme Court, and this is where Wendy Davis won. Wendy Davis, 3 years ago, stood up on the floor and held a, I believe it was 8 or 9 hour filibuster against some really, really hardcore anti-abortion laws. And she successfully ran out the clock, initially defeating it. But then the governor at that time called back the legislator and they passed the laws, the anti-abortion laws, which closed down most of the abortion clinics in the state. So it went to the Supreme Court. And the Supreme Court decided that no, you can't do that. You can't have those kinds of laws. What they were seeking, the Texas legislature, was having what are known as ambulatory regulations in these hospitals. They said they have to have admitting privileges for a local hospital, and the hallways and the buildings have to be wide enough for two gurneys to go by, never mind that most women never even end up on gurneys and that a lot of abortions are able to be done with a pill. And the court saw it that way and said, we don't see how these particular things are protecting women. And they seem extreme. And then, of course, the Texas legislator, their lawyers were unable to cite a case where it helped or saved any women. And they lost. So we did well at the Supreme Court this week.
If you're going to say that the two Democrats running for president both favor pretty much abortion at any time for any reason, and they hide behind the women's health issue, but that could be a migraine headache. You know, okay, I don't want to have the kid. My boyfriend left me. My husband left me, whatever it may be. I got a migraine. Kid's going to be born next week. Let's get the kid.
I don't think that many people get abortions because they have a migraine headache.
It doesn't matter. It's theoretical. When you have two candidates saying they don't want any limitations.
And then, of course, folks like Bill O'Reilly lost at the court this week.
We are one liberal justice away from a five-justice radical leftist majority that would undermine our religious liberty, that would undermine the right to life, and that would fundamentally erase the Second Amendment right to keep and bear arms from the Constitution.
We've done pretty well recently with respect to the agenda here in America. We're making small incremental changes, but we are making changes. And it's very important that those changes continue in whatever capacity we do it. I'm not going to make the case for Hillary Clinton, but I am going to make the case for laying on your legislators. And I don't mean that in a dirty way. I mean getting in touch with your legislators, letting them know what you think, and then, of course, getting out there and voting against them en masse if they do not represent you in your local or national government. There's still a lot of inequality out there. There's still an awful lot of sick people that aren't getting any help. There's one particular story that I read about recently. This from Jezebel. And every so often I bring these stories to the mic and I have to pause for a second and go back up to the microphone. I've done that now. You can't tell because I paused. But just stop what you're doing for a minute and listen to this story. A Florida man has been charged with first-degree premeditated murder. And he told the authorities that he fatally shot his wife because the couple could no longer afford to pay for her costly medication. William J. Hager, an 86-year-old resident at Port St. Lucie, was found by authorities on the afternoon of May 16th in the home that he shared with his wife, Carolyn Hager, after dialing 911 to report the crime and turn himself in. As the New York Times reported, Carolyn Hager, 78, had been ill for the last 15 of more than 50 years that they were married. The cost of her medications had become so burdensome that they could no longer afford it, he said. So on Monday morning, while she was sleeping, he shot her in the head, he told the deputy who came to their Florida home. When a deputy sheriff arrived at the Hager's house Monday afternoon, Mr. Hager told him, I have bad news. According to an affidavit, Ms. Hager's body was propped up with pillows and a bed and covered with a blanket. Mr. Hager had killed her at 7:30 a.m. while she was asleep. According to the affidavit, he placed the gun, a Colt 32 revolver, on the dresser, went into the kitchen of their home, drank coffee, and then called his daughters to tell them what he had done before calling 911. Hey, why didn't that old man just save enough money for his retirement in these private retirement accounts? Why didn't he just go get a job, that lazy bum? I can hear my conservative friends now. Although multiple reports mentioned that Ms. Hager had severe arthritis and other issues, a list of her medications could not be released to the public due to privacy laws. The article also noted that the Hagers had previously filed for bankruptcy in 2011 because of her medical, and that Mr. Hager had one time taken a part-time job at Sears to pay for his wife's medical needs. And even with that, there are still folks out there that will make the case for our private for-profit insurance industry and our drug industry that charges thousands of times more than what the drug actually costs to the end user. And then this from CNBC, the average pay for an S&P 500 CEO was $12.4 million in 2015, or 335 times the pay of a rank-and-file worker, according to a new report by the AFL-CIO. The gap is actually narrower than the one posted in 2014 when CEOs earned $13.5 million, or 373 times the pay of the average worker. The 2015 AFL-CIO Executive Pay Watch compares the average compensation of S&P 500 CEOs with the average pay of a non-supervisory worker as reported by the Bureau of Labor Statistics. Non-supervisory workers earned $36,875 in 2015. The survey also compared CEO pay to that of union workers. Here, the gap between CEO and average worker pay was less than 242 times, while the typical CEO earned more than 819 times what a worker earning minimum wage would have taken home that year. And the argument that's happening right now inside my country is how we can't raise the minimum wage to a living wage because it will bankrupt us. It will kill business. Wait a minute. You have CEOs. If someone's making minimum wage, you have CEOs making 819 times what that minimum wage worker is making. Are you telling me that that CEO is doing 819 times more work than that person flipping burgers, than that person doing landscaping, than that person trimming trees or whatever? Are you telling me that? We can afford to pay these CEOs 819 times what the minimum wage is. One person. But we can't raise the wages to $15 an hour. To make sure that people who work full-time, not lazy layabouts, people who work full-time do not live in poverty. Your argument is invalid.
Thank God our economy today is in a lot better shape under President Obama than it was when Bush left office. You know, my Republican colleagues, they suffer from a very serious mental health issue. It's called amnesia. They forgot where we were when Bush left office. 800,000 jobs a month being lost. And they worry that we're only growing 250,000 jobs a month now. Well, you know what? Maybe 250,000 jobs a month growth is not enough. It's a heck of a lot better than losing 800,000 jobs a month.
In closing, I understand that going forward, Bernie, the man, the one man, does not get to be our standard bearer. But remember, it's about the movement and not the moment. And this, we've made great progress. This is our moment. Do not step outside of this. Do not walk away from this. Do not stop paying attention. Do not stop getting involved. Because we have a lot of work to do. And we are only getting started. Yes, we've done some great things over the last number of years, but we still have a long way to go. And every reason to go forward. Stick with me. Come on. The future looks bright from where I stand. It's not about one man. It's about all of us. And this movement is going on. Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for being here on The Fire You Can't Put Out. Our official home is tfycpo.podbean.com. You can also find us at Kiwi Station. Like us on Facebook at facebook.com/tfycpo. You can listen on the go. Just download the Podbean app at the iTunes Store or at the Google Play Store for Android users. Individual episodes are available for download at the iTunes Store. Just search for The Fire You Can't Put Out. There you can also subscribe so you never miss an episode. Questions, comments, hate mail, or just a general statement or inquiry, you can email us at tfycpo@gmail.com. We work hard to not only inform and entertain, but also to keep an open dialogue with our growing listener base. So for me to reach out to us, and as always, thank you for listening. We are the fire you can't put out, and we will prevail, rejecting austerity in favor of prosperity. Special thanks to Kevin for producing, and thanks to you for listening. You with the headphones on, or whatever you're doing. This is Mel. Signing off. And now that I've woken you up, good morning.